So what I will do, good morning everyone, what I will do is speak about the triad essence power activity or being power activity or substance power activity in Proclus, and I will start from the higher realms, the transcendent realms about which we are reasonably well informed, and then say a few then in the second part of the talk move through the lower world, and unfortunately our information about that is less complete, but I'll try to reconstruct it and explain how the two realms are connected. When in De Malorum Subsistentia, Proclus distinguishes between levels at which things can be affected by evil, he repeatedly refers to the distinction between essence, power, and activities. A major claim, for instance, is that human souls can be affected in their activities and powers, but not in their essence, whereas divine souls can be affected only in their activities. In other words, whatever happens to souls, their powers remain intact, yet their activities can be obstructed. Bodies can be corrupted in all three levels, even in their essence. So that's explained in text one. So my gloss on the apparent evil befalling divine souls consisting in their activities being hampered, namely that there is an external obstruction to the exercise of the powers, relies on an intuition regarding the relation between powers and activities. Powers, I assume, are dispositions to exhibit certain activities. And if powers are intact, there is nothing in them that prevents the activity from being carried out. Hence, if the activities are corrupted, something external to the power must be responsible for that, in which case it makes good sense to speak of an obstruction or an absence of facilitating conditions. As other passages show, this triad is regarded as equivalent to the triad being, life, intellect, which itself reflects the more fundamental triad remaining, procession, reversion. This is brought out in text 2, which I won't read, but the last sentence or the last phrase of that expresses this idea. Now, to say that triads are equivalent or reflect one another does not mean that they express the same or capture the same aspects of triadic structures. In the grand scheme of things, the triad being, life, intellect structures the whole transcendent realm, well, the realm that corresponds to what Plotinus calls intellect, but also structures of a narrower scope within that broad realm are characterized by these three moments, which results in triads like intellective being, intellective life, intellective intellect, or zoogon, or living being, living life, living intellect, and so on. And also much more below, in nature, triads comprising essential, vital, and intellective moments will be found, even in things that are no longer alive or thinking. We will come back to that later. Of these triads, the metaphysically more important one is that of remaining procession reversion, as this explains the way in which realities in a hierarchical order are constituted and relate to one another. The intellective element, that is the ontological moment of understanding, is therefore what conversion consists in, especially at the higher levels. The analogy with the triad being power activity is interesting, in particular as it shows the connection between power in the ontological sense with the principle of life. So there is a connection power, life, and of this the activities are the products. In the same work, Proclus also mentions a triad that is closely related to the one that we have examined so far, will power activity, in text 3, and he calls this the primary triad of goodness. This particular triad is in this form unparalleled in Proclus's work. One can understand it as the more familiar triad being power activity, which with will substituting for being as first member. This substitution is justified if one considers that for divine beings their will is nothing but their being or the direct expression thereof. One could even add that the idea of will as the expression of their essence merely reflects the perspective of beings inferior to them who are the recipients of their powers. In the commentary on the Timaeus, Proclus calls the triad being or essence, power, activity, intelligible, in order to distinguish it from a higher, super essential, hyperousios, one can understand, henadic, triad, goodness, will, providence. As a matter of fact, as you will see in the table on under number 4, Proclus lays out 4 triangles, each at a different level, and subsequently explains the analogies between them. And the levels are the superessential, so the henadic, the intelligible, intellect, and soul, where you see the basic triad being power activities with different names reoccurring. Regarding the intelligible triad, Proclus explains that it stands for the moments of remaining, procession, and reversion. And this intelligible triad is also the triad which will be most important when we will talk later about physical bodies, because this is the triad where the paradigms of these bodies are found. And you see this in text 5 from the same passage. And in conformity with this ineffable and unified triadic structure, the intelligible too is divided 3 ways, by substance and power and activity, substance being enduringly established in itself and self-complete, power maintaining an uninterrupted and infinite procession, and activity having as its portion perfection and essential productivity. So given the analogies, we can infer a few things about how the essence of a thing, its powers and its activities are related. It is clear that as the second is supposed to flow from the first, so the third, so the activities, flow from the second. Hence, the activities stem from the powers and from the essence. The powers stand for the life of any given being, and through the activity, which are on these higher levels cognitive in the proper sense, the thing in question is perfected and returns to itself. There is a strong analogy, but also a marked difference between the use of a triad, for instance, this triad, essence, power, activity, as characterizing and steering the processions of beings in a broad ontological realm, or even in a sub-level of a sub-level, and, on the other hand, the same triad as constitutive of a single entity, like a particular soul or a particular body, even though the latter type of triad is, of course, a reflection of the transcendent triads. So examples of the first type are the 3 levels of the intelligible, in the broad sense of intelligible, comprising intelligible in the strict sense, intelligible intellective, and intellective. Another example, the 3 triads that make up the intelligible in the strict sense. Even they have the same structure. Or the triadic structure of the lowest term in this triad, and so on. The second type, so of a single entity, in this second case, the 3 terms characterize the 3 moments of the ontological structure of a single item, soul or a body. Now this is useful as a conceptual tool to explain, as we have seen, for instance, how or to what extent something can be affected by evil. Now, the difference between the 2 cases of application of the triad, so broader structures versus single beings, may not be so easy to determine with more precision. On the one hand, it is not completely wrong to consider a broad ontological realm as a single hypothesis or as a single entity. So one could conceive of the entire intellective plane as intellect, or even as Plotinus did, the entire intelligible realm, what he called intellect, as a single hypostasis. Now, Iamblichus and his followers, notably Proclus, insisted that there are real and not just conceptual distinctions within this triad, yet they would probably not want to say that this whole realm can in no way be considered as unity. And on the other hand, there is also some legitimacy in considering the different moments, structural moments, that constitute a soul or a body as themselves real and in some sense distinct entities. So the issue could be formulated as one concerning identity conditions. And as far as I know, there's no real good answer in Proclus how to distinguish between these cases. So let us now look at soul, more particularly the type of soul that is participated by body, so human souls, for instance. Of key significance for Proclus' concept of the participated soul is that the soul's activities are situated in time, whereas its essence is not. So the essence of the human soul is outside of time, the activities are not. The essence of soul is constituted eternally by a constitutive self-motion by which it reverts upon itself, but a motion that does not imply passive motion, being moved, being in motion. In other words, the essence of soul is not in motion and is not in time, but its activities are in time. And this is expressed in text 6. Every participated soul has an eternal existence, but a temporal activity. Existence here translates usia, a word that I elsewhere translated as essence or sometimes substance or being. And the soul is self-constituted in its essence, and in a way this also must be occurring according to the same triad. This is different, and intellect, of course, and the activities and the powers flow from that essence. Now, if we contrast the case of intellect, text 7, every intelligence has its existence, its potency, and its activity in eternity. So with intellect, all three are eternal. Now, the activities of the soul are discursive and involve transitions from A to B, merely in time as far as its mental activities are concerned, also transitions in place from A to B insofar as its activities involving the body are concerned. So he says the soul has a transitive activity, metabatikos energei, and its motions are characterized by the before and the after. In the very last proposition of the work Elements of Theology, Proclus emphatically repeats that every soul thinks transitively and has no part that thinks in a non-transitive manner, a claim amounting to an unambiguous rejection of Plotinus' theory of the undescendent soul. A bit earlier in the text, in 191, he does not specify the status of the power. So the text that we looked at earlier on, he said where the essence is eternal, the activities in time. He didn't say anything about the powers. To get a grasp on this issue, we would need to know how exactly Proclus conceives of the nature of a power. The essence is superior to the activities, and the power is between both. The power is derived from being and generates the activities, which is said in text 8, energeias usa gonimos. So the power generates the activities. Now, I will just briefly summarize an argument. Given the fact that in De Malorum Subsistentia, he says that the powers of some souls can be affected and of other souls not, if the powers are affected, that must mean that they are themselves also in time. So I can supplement, based on De Malorum Subsistentia, the text from the proposition 191 of the Elements of Theology to say that also the powers must be in time. Now we come to the section where we start to talk about the physical world, and with the notion that which is divisible in association with bodies. In accordance with Plato's account of the composition of the soul in the Timaeus 35a, Proclus holds the soul to be intermediate between indivisible being and that which is or that which becomes divisible around bodies. Text number 9. Every soul is intermediate between the indivisible principles and those which are divided in association with bodies. Now, the indivisible entities are intellect and everything above intellect. But the identification of these inferior principles, which will occupy us for the rest of the talk, is more difficult. Now, one should resist the temptation to equate these realities with bodies. So some contemporary interpreters of Timaeus say that when Plato writes that which becomes invisible, so perita somata miriste, that means the divisibility of bodies. But that's not what Proclus thinks. He thinks that these principles are, in a way, principles that become divisible when they are in the realm of bodies. So due to the contact with bodies, they become divisible. But in themselves, they are higher principles, and higher in the sense transcending the body, yet inferior to the soul, because they're so in between the soul and the body, but still transcendent principles, out of themselves indivisible, but of such a nature as to become divisible when they are peri, bodies. I will use the shorthand divisible principles, although strictly speaking that is not so correct. In the Elements of Theology, Proclus does not say much about the identity of these principles. So I start with a few texts from the Elements of Theology, see how far we get, and then move to other texts like the Timaeus commentary. Now, why doesn't he say much in the Elements of Theology? Well, because the scope is restricted to the level of soul at the lower end. So he starts with the one and he goes down to soul, but not beyond that. He just mentions those features of the divisible principles that are needed to demarcate them from the soul and to explain their relation to the soul. And for more information, we will then have to turn to other texts. The soul is not just superior to the divisible principles, it is also their cause. Text 10. And as their cause, it already contains, in the mode of the paradigm, the constituents of these principles. And those will in turn be causes for realities posterior to them, in casu the physical world. So these divisible principles transmit that power of the soul. That is why the soul can be said, so the soul and not just these principles, the soul can be said to contain all the logoi of the natural world, although the soul logoi are passed onto bodies through the intermediary of these divisible principles. Text 11, accordingly it, so the soul, pre-embraces all sensible things after the manner of a cause, possessing the rational notions, tous logos, of material things immaterially, of bodily things incorporeally, of extended things without extension. Now, these divisible principles are divisible, but that is due to the fact that they are co-extended with bodies. Text 12. For such principles are wholly inseparable from their substrates. So they cannot be separated any longer from the substrate. They are partitioned together with the partitioned bulk, and falling away from their nature, from their, let's say, transcendent nature, which is without parts, they are infected by corporeal extension. If they be of the order of vital principles, they belong as life principles, not to themselves, but to their participants. If they be of the order of being and the forms, they belong as forms, not to themselves, but to that which they inform. So these principles provide form and life to the things of which they are principles, and contrary to soul, lose their own nature of pure, incorporeal, and unextended principles, and they come to belong to their effects. It's at this level that we get near the forms that are immanent to physical bodies, and principles of life that are inseparably linked to animal bodies. As I've argued elsewhere, the irrational and vegetative functions of the soul, what Proclus calls the shadow of the soul, are among these divided principles, as well as the formal causes of bodies. And Proclus thinks that this is what Aristotle means when he talks about the form of a hylomorphic compound, the form as a formal cause. So here we had two types, but the next text, 13, distinguishes three types. For if the soul is intermediate between the indivisible forms and those which are divided in association with the body, it is neither indivisible in the same sense as all the intellectual kinds, nor divided in the same sense as those assimilated to body. Accordingly, whereas the substantial, vital, and cognitive principles, and here we see our triad again, the triad that being life intellect that corresponds to essence power activity. So whereas these principles are in corporeal things disjoint from one another, so they exist as in a way as separate principles, in souls they exist as a unity without division and so on. The soul has no parts, but the body has parts and is divided. Proclus hints at different types here of principles that are subsumed under the term divisible principles. So all these three categories fall under divisible principles. Some provide being, others provide life, others cognition. If we turn to the Platonic theology briefly, Proclus informs us that on his interpretation of the Parmenides, the fourth hypothesis deals with these divisible principles, text 14. And in the commentary on the Parmenides, he names as the object of this hypothesis unmattered things. Now, some people have concluded, for instance, the translation by Diller and Morrow suggests that they are the unmattered forms, but I think the unmattered forms are just one instance of them. So the unmattered forms belong to these divisible principles, but there are more types of divisible principles. A further passage from the Platonic theology, text 16, confirms the idea that the divisible natures are not bodies and are in fact incorporeal in virtue of their capacity of active motion. They are in fact moved movers, being moved by things external to them and in turn moving other things. And as examples here, Proclus mentions unmattered forms, anula eide, and qualities, poiotetes. This, contrary to, I'm sorry, I didn't have a translation of the Platonic theology, but I've just summarized the text. This is contrary to bodies who do not have a moving power. This is said in text 17. So, qua body, bodies cannot move anything. They are merely passive. Now, if bodies are said to move other things, it is in virtue of the divisible powers present in them. So Proclus denies the fact that one body can move another. What really does the moving are these qualities, these unmattered forms, and so on, in the bodies. But since they are inseparable from the bodies, you could say in practice it makes no difference, but it's a matter of conceptual clarity here. Now let's turn to the commentary on the Timaeus to establish some more details regarding the divisible principles. The context of the discussion is again the composition of the soul, which is intermediate between the indivisible and the divisible. Text 18. Divisible includes all being which proceeds into the realm of bodies, whether this means the living things within the cosmos, zoas, or natures, physes, which makes this way, or physical logoi, logos physicus. In this first part of the passage, he has mentioned several types of things that fall under divisible. So lives, natures, and natural logoi. This is then followed by an ascending list in the second part of the text. Some have been placed in such bodies and are in a subject, while others possess a substantial form of life that is still inseparable from bodies, as in the case of natures. Some which are divided nonetheless bring themselves together into something indivisible, as is the case in perception. So what is this list? First, lowest are forms that are immersed in bodies and exist in them as in a substrate. So one can think of the formal principles of bodies qua inanimate bodies. Second are principles of life. Here one can think of vegetative and appetitive principles of life in the, what is called the irrational soul and in the soul entelechy. They have a substantial character but are nonetheless inseparable from their bodies. An example that Proclus gives is nature as a principle. And third and highest among the principles mentioned here are those that end in some form of indivisibility, such as the powers of perception, which, like the former, belong to the irrational soul, but contrary to the former are cognitive principles. The powers of perception indeed produce unified perceptions of things and present them to the rational soul. In the second part of the same passage, so that's the text 19, Proclus describes the same triadic structure that we have already encountered in Elements of Theology 197, so in text 13, and explains the analogies with the triad of the indivisible, namely being, life, intellect, and specifies the intermediate position of the corresponding psychic triad. And if you are willing to speak in these terms, say that the indivisible being is triple: that which is indivisible with respect to being, that which is indivisible with respect to life, and that which is indivisible with respect to thinking. And the sort of being that is divisible in the realm of bodies is triple too. Opposed to the kind of being that is indivisible with reference to thought is the kind that is divisible with reference to perception. Opposed to that which is indivisible with reference to life is that which is divisible with reference to nature. And opposed to that which is indivisible with respect to being is that which is divisible with reference to the divisible forms in the realm of bodies. And now a crucial sentence. While the latter three, so the lower triad, are images of the former, they have an order of precedence in relation to one another that is contrary to the order among the earlier ones. Proclus draws our attention to a special feature of the lower triad. The order is reversed. What he means is not that the axiology of the three terms is reversed, but rather, as we shall see in more detail below, that the order of their manifestation is reversed. As he explains elsewhere, whereas in the transcendent realms, different ontological levels proceed the one from the other in such a manner that wholes are prior to parts, in the material world, parts precede wholes. And down here, the priority is temporal. For instance, in the creation of physical bodies, including animal bodies, first the parts are produced, and wholes are formed out of a combination of parts. A similar reversal can be observed for the compounds of bodies with the powers that animate them. So first the body is formed by the formal principles proper to it, then vegetative powers are added. These are equated with Aristotle's soul as entelechy of the body. And only then sensory powers are added. And those in turn will be followed by rational psychic principles. But this is something that he doesn't mention here. But the others he mentions. He does specify that the psychic triad, as being intermediary between the indivisible and the divisible, shares features of both. It retains the order of principles that we find in the higher realms, but is affected by divisibility like the lower. Now, we should try to get more clarity about what are exactly and how many are these principles. Proclus does not always give the same list of divisible principles. If one pieces different texts together, we can broadly distinguish irrational powers of the soul, one should say of the shadow of the soul, because the term soul is restricted to the rational soul. So irrational powers of the soul, and these are sensory, appetitive, and vegetative. Then second, reason principles, logoi, and mattered forms. All of these are causes that shape and lend purpose to the material world. As causes, they should be immaterial and sources of motion. These principles are reflections of higher causes and enter the world through soul and nature, and steer all purposeful biological and natural processes. The images of transcendent forms in the soul and in nature are usually designated as logoi. Logoi is taken here in a broader sense than logoi as one type of divisible principle, which falls under it. As a general rule, the lower the principle, the more diversified it becomes and the more division it allows, as the copies are always less unified than the model. And ultimately, at the end of this graded descent, the last image will be the form that is immanent to a material compound and that determines the shape of the compound. I cite a text from the Parmenides commentary, by restraining matter, and it provides determination to the unlimitedness and shapelessness of matter. So compounds of form and matter are material bodies, but in fact, there are hylomorphic structures at many different levels. If one understands hylomorphic as a term designating the interaction of a principle of limitation with that of unlimitedness, although Proclus objects to the use of the word hyle in these cases, he says we should rather say apeiron, but that doesn't really matter. That's a terminological issue. So the Aristotelian form-matter compound is, Proclus says, only the tenth and lowest level of the principles peras and apeiron manifesting themselves. As Proclus understands them, Aristotelian forms of hylomorphic compounds are no longer causes. So it's wrong to call them cause, as they are the mere effects of true causes and lack all efficiency. So you have these divisible forms that cause something, namely the form of the body, but the form of the body is itself no longer a cause. It is just a dead effect. All true principles, so-called divisible principles included, are alive. The lowest forms are dead. They are the qualitative configurations, the substrate of the substrate from which all particular bodies are made. The immanent forms of bodies are not identical with qualities, nor with the so-called enmetered forms, because qualities and enmetered forms are still principles. Text 20. Suppose someone were to say that both the enmetered forms and the qualities themselves were grasped by sense, and nonetheless have generation even though they are incorporeal. Well, let this objector know that the divine Iamblichus says that these also contribute to the subsistence of bodies and are considered together with them. So these are living causes included in nature. And text 21 gives one example of that, the nature of individual animals and more particularly the mother of living beings, Proclus there says contains reason principles potentially not actually. The seed contains reason principles potentially not actually. For being a body, it cannot have the reason principles undividedly and actually. So what then is it that possesses them actually? So in actuality, that will be the nature of the mother in this case. At a level higher than this, the principles of all natural things are already contained in the whole, nature of the whole. That's text 22. We shall compel our respondent to admit that the reason principles, that is, the creative and moving powers of all things, are contained in it, and it stands for the nature of the whole, and the universal nature. These principles fashion all living and, more broadly, all natural things. Although the divisible principles are very closely associated with bodies and in their lowest manifestations have no existence independent of their bodies, as principles they still to some extent transcend their bodies. This stops being true only for the very lowest formal structures, those forms which Proclus thinks are the Aristotelian form, and they are no longer principles. So in my last section, the last section of my paper, I will look not any longer at the whole realm of divisible principles, but only at those that structure or are principles of bodies qua inanimate bodies, so just physical bodies. In a fragment from the lost part of Book 5 of the Commentary on the Timaeus, preserved by Philoponus, Proclus provides us with precious information that allows us to determine the relation between enmetered form and qualities with greater precision. So he talks about enmetered forms and qualities. Maybe it is better to say that also the annula aede, and not just the poiotetes, are called things that enter and leave. So that's an expression from the Timaeus. Things enter the receptacle and leave the receptacle. What are these? He says, well, not just qualities, but also enmetered forms. For the enmetered forms, not the qualities, are likenesses of the intelligibles. So Plato, of course, says it is the images of the intelligibles that enter the receptacle. So that's where he's looking for. Proclus argues that when forms... he's arguing what is really the image of the intelligible is the enmetered form, not the poiotes. And the poiotes will be an image of the enmetered form, so lower. And he further argues that when these forms leave the receptacle, they do not go anywhere, so they don't go to another place, but just stop to exist. He is attacked for this view by Philoponus. That's why Philoponus cites it, because Philoponus perceives an inconsistency between what he says here and other forms, other views that Proclus holds, and that are incompatible with Philoponus' own religious and philosophical views. So what Proclus says here fits Philoponus' idea very well, namely the idea that things can be created out of nothing and can just stop to exist. This is a welcome idea to Philoponus, and he sees it in this feature of Proclus' theory. Text 24 gives you a passage from the commentary by Cyrianus on the Metaphysics that confirms this idea of forms just disappearing. The passage excerpted by Philoponus from the fifth book of Proclus' commentary on the Timaeus implies that enmetered forms, annula aede, are superior to qualities, the latter being copies either of the enmetered forms or of some intermediates. The natural reason principles, so the logoi, that divide themselves over qualityless corporeality, that's a phrase you find in this passage, he also calls forms that divide themselves over the masses of bodies. So this shows that he uses here logoi and eide indiscriminately. But where greater precision is required, he distinguishes logoi from immanent forms. For instance, in the discussion of Timaeus 31c, 32a, he establishes a clear threefold distinctions. 1. Logoi, 2. Enula Ede, 3. Poiotetes. We will look at the passage shortly. Moreover, as we already know, since unmattered forms are incorporeal and living causes, they cannot be identical with the immanent dead forms. Let us look more closely at Proclus' exegesis of Timaeus 31c. So there, Plato mentions three things: number, mass, and power. So arithmos, onkos, dynamis. And Proclus interprets them as principles of ordinary bodies. So, and these principles correspond to the expressions that we have already examined. So I'll skip the text, but point you to the table that you find hopefully on your handout. Yes. So below the text is a table with the correspondences. So on the one hand, you have arithmoi, onkoi, dynames. That's the text from the Timaeus. And Proclus says, well, the first are the unmattered forms, enula ede. The masses are the extensions and spatializations of the unmattered forms in the vicinity of matter. Ektases, diastases, hyperiten hyle. The dynames, 3, are here equated with the cohesive and form-imparting qualities. Forms are indivisible and unextended, a feature that they share with mathematical numbers. That is why Proclus uses the concept of physical number in 1. He has added physical to denote unmattered forms. When these forms enter matter, they become spatially extended. They, as it were, and then the images are, they unfurl powers or they project unmattered powers, enhulos dynames, that manifest themselves as qualities. So these powers then get manifested as qualities. And these qualities are not just accidental qualities, but rather those qualities that constitute the formal aspect of the body and that make the body into a unified whole, being what it is. That's why he says synecticae kai edo poioi. So they are, as it were, substantial qualities or essential qualities. Such qualities are, in the examples he offers, for instance, the heat of fire, the fluidity of water, qualities that are constitutive of the essence of their substances. The substance or essence of the bodies lies in the unextended and mattered form, so level 1, which specifies the identity of the body to be produced. Now, Proclus presents this triad, which even at this micro level preserves the fundamental structure being power activity in a telescoped fashion. Whereas in the terminology of the text he is interpreting, power, dynamis, is the third term. In Proclus metaphysics, as we have seen, it is typically the middle term of the three. Hence, I think, in his account, that which flows out from the substantial form and becomes spatialized is already called power. On the other hand, in this text, he hardly distinguishes between the second and the third level, and he even says that the unmattered form projects its powers, which are qualities. So he says the powers are qualities. If one wants to preserve the triad and keep the power in the middle position, one could understand him to be saying that the form projects powers which become qualities, namely, as soon as they become constitutive of bodies. Constitutive but not constituents, right? The constituent would still be this dead form. When Proclus goes on to discuss the function of the proportions needed to keep together the three forms, he returns to the triadic structure, which he explains, moreover, through the triad remaining procession reversion. Connecting the synectic and unifying function of the middle term, a function which he had just before associated with the qualities, the third term. So below that is something what is not mentioned here, but we could call it the qualified, if we briefly look at Simplicius' analysis of quality and qualified in the commentary on the categories, we can see that it is broadly compatible with this picture. The qualified is, I think, that which corresponds to the very lowest level of the this formal structuring, the mere effect. We are now also in a better position to understand the fragment preserved by Philoponus. What enters the receptacle are forms, which are images of transcendent forms and which are sometimes called logoi. They unfurl themselves to become qualities. Now, qualities are themselves true principles. What they produce are qualifieds, that is, objects characterized by a certain quality, or also the particular quality, one could call it a trope, possessed by these bodies. It's interesting that in text 25, Proclus uses the example of the material elements and their qualities. These qualities are substantial and extended, but are not themselves the substance or essence of fire, which is unextended, he says. So you have an unextended essence of fire, extended qualities. The essence precedes the powers and the qualities, and the latter flow from the substance of fire. He says substance takes precedence over powers. However, the reversal that I mentioned earlier, reversal of the sequence that is typical of things produced in matter, introduces a further complication. For the sequence of realization of the unmattered forms appears to be bottom-up. This is clear from Proclus' interpretation of geometric atomism, so the theory of the elements in the Timaeus. According to the theory, as it was further developed, the demiurge creates the elements by imparting geometrical shapes onto the substrate. Proclus holds the view, extraordinary to modern ears, that at their proper level, geometrical entities are not extended. This is also true for the demiurgic forms and logoi of the geometric shapes that constitute the essence of the four elements. You could say that the logos, as it were, defines what a triangle is, but is not itself extended. When these enter the cosmos, they become spatialized and divisible. Now, if you look at the Timaeus, the construction of the elemental particles starts from the simplest shapes, the triangles. They are combined into wholes, polyhedra. Each larger group of polyhedra counts as an occurrence of the element corresponding to its type. The shapes and dynamic interactions of the qualities ground further qualitative properties. And this is what played. So you see that it is built up from below, starting from the triangles, going to polyhedra, elements, qualities of the elements. The text of the Timaeus I've given to you, but since you probably all know it, I will not read it. Proclus interprets qualitative properties such as hot and cold as somehow supervening upon the more fundamental, that is, the more basic or lower geometric qualities of the elemental corpuscles. Somehow, these qualitative properties are prefigured and causally anticipated in the substantial, unextended geometric form, which is the entity that, according to Proclus, enters the receptacle and there becomes an unmattered form. So we have the problem that, on the one hand, these qualities are built from below, so from the triangles you see how the qualities emerge. On the other hand, they are already contained in the shape that enters the receptacle from above. So how to bring these two accounts together? So the essential forms coming down become spatialized, gives rise to the properties belonging to it, namely the basic geometric shapes. This in turn is made possible because there is already a receptacle that has been caused by principles even higher than the demiurge. So there has to be some kind of condition of receptivity already in place, and you can see that at every level. So because of the presence of the substrate, divisibility and extension is imposed upon the forms that enter it. So divine principles, as I said, have already created this. Now, once the forms are in the receptacle and given certain physical conditions, for instance, the shape of the world, the inward pressure of the outer sphere, which prevents the formation of pockets of void, the lack of equilibrium, anomalia, Plato says, within the receptacle. So all these elements together produce interactions of the elements and certain phenomena that receive the names of higher level properties like warm and cold. Viewed at the level of the brute corpuscular forces, they are nothing but the phenomena of collision, cutting, compressing, and so on. They can be described alternatively as instantiations of the higher level properties hot and cold, even independently of their being perceived. So there is hotness and coldness in the physical world, even if we don't perceive. So the very same phenomena then, when they are perceived, become by sentient beings, are the result, again, of the same type of interactions with sense organs. And they become sense properties. Now, all of this was planned by demiurgic providence and by higher forms of providence. Causes superior to the demiurge provide the receptacle. The demiurge and the demiurges, plural, have blueprints for realizing qualitative properties like hot and cold. So, in a way, the demiurge wants to realize hotness and coldness. That's what he sets out to do. But in order to realize these properties in such a way that regularities are preserved on a cosmic scale and also on much smaller scales, they have to instantiate geometric structure. So how to realize hotness and coldness by creating or instantiating geometric structures in matter whose nature is such that combined and given all these conditions, they produce these qualities. So there is a form or logos of a given quality, say warmth, in the mind of the demiurge and in the souls of lower demiurgic forces. And there are also logoi of triangles and polyhedra. The geometric forms are introduced into the receptacle so that in the conditions of the receptacle, warmth is produced, both at the level of elemental interactions, where warmth explains the nature of a certain type of phenomenon, and at the level of sensory perception, where the same term denotes a type of perception. This warmth is at the same time an instantiation of the logos of warmth and can be said to be a copy of it, which needed to be instantiated. A similar account can be given of the elements themselves. So the first example was one of the qualitative properties, now the elements. So Proclus believes that material fire is the image of a demiurgic logos of fire. Alternatively, it can be described as being generated from more simple building blocks. In the temporal sequence, the building blocks are produced first. But in the ontological sequence of the paradigmatic causes, the sequence is the reverse. Up there, one could also say, in terms of intelligibility in the literal sense, what you can understand, the wholes precede the parts. Just like the substrate is a recipient that is apt to receive the triangles, so the enmeshed geometric shapes can be regarded as providing the required epitedeiotes, aptitude, for the elements, as they are described in qualitative terms, like hot or fluid, in virtue of which they are given their traditional names. Insofar as the analysis of the physical world is concerned, the bottom-up causal analysis is thus compatible with the top-down causal analysis, precisely because production in the physical realm entails the aforementioned reversal of sequence. And given the fact that these divine minds are so incredibly clever, everything nicely fits. If one looks at the properties of elements at a purely material level, so just look at the properties and do not take into account forms, demiurgic forms, natural logoi, one would see just a bundle of properties that are merely held together by spatio-temporal contiguities. In each case, they are properties of one and the same corpuscle, or more accurately, properties that through relations of spatial-temporal contiguity make up a single corpuscle. We would also observe higher level properties being grounded in, and in some cases causally produced by, more basic properties. If, however, we also take into account the descending lineage of principles, we would tell a different story, and also one that provides a higher insight. Here, essences generate and ground powers, which in turn generate and ground activities. Activities being the manifestations that also show the essence. And Proclus wants us to understand how both accounts understand both accounts and their compatibility. Thank you.